Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Things in Afghanistan went from bad to worse this week as an apparent terrorist attack on would-be Afghan refugees seeking to flee Afghanistan killed a dozen U.S. military personnel and an undisclosed number of Afghanis. The bombing and gun attack took place at one of the entrance gates to the main airport in Kabul. And while it is not known who perpetrated the attack, it is suspected to have been carried out by an Islamic militant group that is at odds with both the Taliban and the U.S. The tragedy underscores the deeper shock and sadness and fear that are shared by many Afghans over the anticipated reprisals and oppression that the Taliban may inflict once the Western military presence is concluded. Last week, we featured a number of speakers talking about the history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and how we arrived at this particular flashpoint. This week, we have another panel that gets into a little more detail and offers some hints at the best course for the U.S. foreign policy moving forward. Last week, I articulated a thesis that there never was a military solution in Afghanistan and that strategic aid, lots and lots of it, would have been the best strategy. Well, now we're beginning to see reports that China is starting to step into that void by offering financing and material assistance for much-needed infrastructure improvements. Our panelists today touch on that, too. Unfortunately, one of the panelists, former Loya Jirga MP Malalai Joya, spoke from exile via video chat, and her audio was very hard to follow. She too, however, called for massive reparations and pointed out that she and other Afghan women had been opposed to the Western intervention from the start. We'll start with one of the panelists we heard from last week, analyst Phyllis Bennis.
We know that today we're learning about a new round of bombing that took place in Afghanistan overnight, that the United States carried out new airstrikes that were designed to, as one general put it to the New York Times, just buy time. We're just buying time for the Afghan military. And of course, that buying of time is purchased at the cost of Afghan civilian lives, as has been the case for so long. The U.S. war in Afghanistan that began on October 7th, 2001, less than 3 weeks after the attacks on 9/11 that it was ostensibly designed to respond to, has always been a transactional war. It has always been about U.S. interests, for sure, interests involving pipelines and mining and location, strategic location, but not in the context of real strategic value. This war was a preparation for the war to come in Iraq. And again, the price has always been paid by Afghans, not by people in this country. People in this country did pay about $2 trillion so far for the war in Afghanistan. Things like $20 billion in 1 year to pay for air conditioning for US soldiers, for instance. But the overwhelming price has been paid by Afghans. The price in civilian lives, the price in lives destroyed, the price to the earth, to the land, social connections that were shredded across Afghan society. And yet, as we know, in terms of how this war began, the war began at a moment when we were being told in this country and around the world, everything had changed on 9/11, that the world had changed. In fact, the world did not change on 9/11. 9/11 was an enormous crime, a crime against humanity. 3,000 people killed in one moment. And yet this was not something that changed the world. What changed the world came a day later on 9/12, the day that George Bush announced to the world that his response to this crime would be to take the world to war. And that war, what he first called
your TV,
the global war on terror, has been an extraordinary failure. It failed to, quote, end terrorism around the world. It failed to bring democracy to Afghanistan. It failed to produce women's rights, human rights across Afghanistan. What it did not fail to do was to set the stage for an even greater war, a more destructive war in Iraq. The Afghanistan papers that were made up of a huge trough of information coming directly from the Pentagon that had been leaked to a host of news organizations around the world, starting with the Washington Post, made very clear the lies, just like Vietnam, just like Iraq, that the lies that had gone into the justifications for this war, the evidence that was hid, the evidence that this war was unwinnable from the beginning, that was known by every general leading this war, all of that was exposed in a very public way. But when did that happen? That happened in December of 2019. And just a couple of weeks later, the pandemic took over the attention of the world, and the focus on the Afghanistan papers was very, very short-lived as a result. Even the name, George Bush's Global War on Terror, morphed into what's now called the Forever Wars. Barack Obama, who had said memorably that he would end the dumb war in Iraq, had made very clear that he intended to maintain the war in Afghanistan, as he did. He called it, he gave it the very anodyne name of overseas contingency operations, right? It sounds like global firefighters bringing kittens out of trees or some such thing. And now it's known as the Forever Wars. And we're going to end the Forever Wars, we hear from President Biden, by withdrawing ground troops. We heard that as well from President Obama, until he decided, actually, no, instead, I think we will send more troops. And of course, in his first year, he sent 47,000 more troops to Afghanistan. And by 2011, while ground troops began to be pulled back, the nature of the war shifted. It shifted to become an air war. And with an air war, civilian casualties massively escalated. And yet US military casualties dropped to almost nothing. And when there are no US military casualties, United States media drops to nothing. So the war continued, Afghans continued to die year after year after year after year, with very little attention coming from anywhere in the world. What we're seeing now is that there is a withdrawal underway. The small number of US and allied ground troops are being withdrawn. That does not end the war. It does end at some point, not yet clearly, but at some point it will end the US role in this war. And it is necessary, I think, for the US troops to be withdrawn, for the Afghans to figure out how to end their own war. Something that Malalai Joya said back in 2009, I think, is critical. She said, we in civil society, we women, have three enemies in my country. The Taliban are certainly our enemies. The warlords disguised as a government are certainly the enemy. And the US occupation is our enemy. And she looked at me, this was at an anti-NATO protest in Strasbourg in 2009. We were running away from the tear gas. And she looked at me and she said, if you guys could get one of those out, we'd only have two. It was a very pragmatic approach, I think. The possibilities are legion for how things may move forward. The Taliban seems to be going through some changes that when foreign forces are out, they are likely to have a different approach to how they deal with people inside. We should keep in mind that the claims about how terrible the Taliban is towards women always leaves out how terrible the Afghan government is towards women. 20 years of US occupation. When occupation began, when the overthrow of the Taliban began in 2001, Afghanistan was the worst country in the world for a woman to survive childbirth or for a child to live to her first or fifth birthday. Today, after 20 years of US occupation, Afghanistan is still the worst place in the world for a child to be born and think she could live to her first or fifth birthday. It's no longer the very worst place for a woman to survive childbirth. It's number 9 out of 190 countries. It's almost as bad. So this is what we are now looking at. I know I have only a moment left, and I want to just say that I think we have to come to the understanding that there never was a military solution to the complicated challenges facing the people of Afghanistan, their own issues of human rights, their own need to rebuild their own country as they saw it, not in the image of the United States with the kind of government that was imposed on Afghanistan. The new militias that we're seeing rising just in the last 2 weeks are an absolute mimic of the militias that fought in the 1990s with the Taliban and then against the Taliban. And all of these militias, as Malalai taught us years ago, are very much the enemies of civil society, of women, of democratic forces inside Afghanistan. Getting rid of the US and British and NATO troops is a critical thing that has to happen. It's critical that we end the air war that has taken over from the ground troops. The air wars that will no longer be based in Afghanistan, but will be based maybe in Qatar, maybe somewhere else, but they will manage to fly to drop more bombs. That will not mean an end to the war. That will not mean an end to the civilian casualties. There is no military solution. And while we now know there has been an enormous shift in political opinion, particularly in the United States, where we had 80% support for the war within a week of the US going to war 20 years ago, we now have 76% of the population saying all troops should be withdrawn. But people still are not thinking enough about what that leaves behind. The planes, the drones that are continuing to kill Afghan civilians. That's the continuation of our job. That's the continuation of those of us who fought against this war from day one, as did Stop the War. This is the new reality. The United States has spent 20 years supporting a corrupt and incompetent government, an army incapable.
Phyllis,
and, yeah.
I'll have to, yeah.
Am I out?
Yeah. You can
Let
say,
me just
you
say
can
one say last line, yeah, and sure, that is sure. That there is a reason that Afghanistan has for so long been called the graveyard of empires. It's not because Afghan soldiers are not good fighters. It's because right now what we see is that they have nothing that they are fighting for.
Fascinating. It seems as though I might have to take over the chairing of the meeting because Sweta's internet kept cutting out then. So I hope that everyone can hear me. My name's Tarina and I work at Stop the War. Our next speaker is going to be Labour Councillor Maya Evans. She's a peace campaigner, a member of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and has been a regular visitor to Afghanistan. So welcome to you, Maya.
Thank you, and I'm really honoured to be part of this incredible panel this evening. And I'm also really pleased that Stop the War are marking the anniversary, the 20-year anniversary, and highlighting this withdrawal, disastrous war. So I've been up to Afghanistan 10 times over roughly the last 10 years, and I have been working in solidarity with mainly youth peace activists in Kabul. And so a lot of what I will talk about tonight is a reflection of some of the visits that I've made to Afghanistan and the accounts that some of my friends tell me about. I'd just like to reflect before I start on this 20-year war, which has actually been 40 years of conflict and violence in Afghanistan, because of course remembering that the Russians invaded in 1979 and it's just been destabilized ever since. But to summarize the last 20 years of US and NATO occupation is to say that it's basically chaos and disaster. The situation hasn't improved for people in Afghanistan. If anything, the situation has greatly worsened. So over the last 20 years, if we remember a month after 9/11, the US invaded Afghanistan. They invaded with the promise to topple the Taliban, to liberate Afghan women, and to capture bin Laden. 20 years later, US and NATO had installed a puppet government. So a lot of the people in the Afghan government today are warlords with blood on their hands from the civil war in the 90s. Women have not been included in the peace negotiations that have been taking place over the last 2 years in Doha. And it took the US actually 10 years to locate bin Laden, who was hiding out in Pakistan, and to assassinate him there. So the peace talks in Doha the last 2 years, which have included the Taliban and US special envoy, have been, I would say, pretty disingenuous, because throughout the peace talks, the Taliban have been carrying out attacks on civilian buildings, on bazaars, schools, hospitals, and the US have also been carrying out airstrikes. And as we know from the news, these violent attacks on both sides of only intensifying with the withdrawal. So we know that the US are still carrying out airstrikes and the Taliban are still carrying out attacks on civilian buildings. So the what has resulted for 2 years of peace negotiations in Qatar, the Taliban have been made to promise to never accommodate an international terrorist organization such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And it's quite important to reflect, actually, that the Taliban, they were never great friends with bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. They kind of tolerated them and felt that they owed bin Laden and Al-Qaeda a favor because they came to Afghanistan to help fight against the Russians, which obviously was a proxy war that the Americans fought by weaponizing the Mujahideen to fight against the Russians. The other thing that the Taliban had to promise was a power share with the Afghan government. So the Afghan government, mainly consisting generally a lot of warlords, and the Taliban generally refused to accept the legitimacy of what they call a puppet government installed by the Americans when they were toppled in 2001. And the Taliban have been pretty confident. They know that they can play the waiting game. They know that they're very hard to defeat. The terrain in Afghanistan is really difficult for foreign forces. And they have really played the long game. They fled to the mountains in 2001 and they've sat it out and they've been confident. And they don't want to have a power share with the Afghan government. They want the lion's share of power. And over the last 2 years, we've seen the Taliban inch power across most of the rural provinces. At the moment, the major cities are still under the power of the Afghan government, but we know there's been a lot of intense fighting in Lashkargah over the last few days. And that looks like it could be the first city to fall. And there's also intensive fighting in Kandahar and Herat. So over the last 20 years, for women, let's remember one of the key reasons for the US and NATO countries going into Afghanistan. Let's not forget Sherry Blair was around at the time inviting Afghan women to Downing Street and talking about how important it was for women's rights. They haven't featured much at all during the peace talks. They've been very much a token contribution. They've rarely been invited to any of the rounds, and when their contributions have been made, they haven't been taken seriously. And women's rights have not been part of the final peace deal. And as Malai Joya says, that actually improvements haven't been hugely significant for Afghan women. From my observation, it's mainly women in Kabul who have benefited. And I mean, that's fantastic that young women in Kabul are getting to access education. But in the rural provinces, life for a lot of young women stay the same. And as Malloy Joya says, there's still forced teen marriages. Women are still imprisoned in their homes, not able to leave without male attendants, not able to attend school. And I mean, I want to acknowledge that for a lot of middle class Afghan women, the situation has improved. They've been able to take jobs, whereas under the Taliban, they haven't. But in no way has this been a great revolutionary liberating experience for Afghan women. The legislation that was passed didn't go anywhere near enough to be actually serious about liberating women. So, for example, if a woman runs away from her husband who is being violent towards her, still, it's illegal for her to run away unless she goes to the police station. And there's a lot of endemic corruption within the police, so the chances are they would return that woman to her husband. Or she can run away to a male member of the family. And again, culture hasn't really progressed enough for women to have solidarity from male members of the family. So there really haven't been fantastic great gains in terms of legislation. I'd like to share a comment from one of my friends, Zainab, a 24-year-old young woman who is an incredible activist. Herself, she witnessed her father murdered by the Taliban when she was 8 years old, when her family fled to the mountains to avoid the oncoming of the Taliban, whom they knew they were going to be attacked by. And in a recent Vox Pop that we put into our newsletter, she said, "The Afghan people don't know what the US troops are doing here. Every day they are killing by explosions, drones, weapons. The US troops have just made a land of conflict so they can bring more guns and kill people in different ways. They have made Afghanistan into a poor country whose people are so tired of what is going on and given more power to the Taliban. I think they should know that this country needs life, health, education, childcare. Women are so tired of military solutions. Also, they should know that here we need peace. I am a woman who hasn't seen any change after these years. Still, we lose our families in war. I think only women can bring peace to Afghanistan. And then she goes on to add, I'm very worried about women. When the Taliban get more involved and gain power, women will lose their rights, especially to education. We'll go back to wearing burqa. We will see violence, not able to get food or any basic needs. No one will hear women's voices. So the last 20 years, we will reflect Operation Enduring Freedom was to win hearts and minds. And it's generally been, I think, a complete failure. And I would point to things like mass airstrikes, drone attacks. Let's not forget that Afghanistan has been the field testing for Britain to test out its drone arsenal. Drones are obviously an airstrike notorious for killing civilians. I've met many Afghans who talk about night raids. They have relatives, friends who have been victims of US night raids. Bagram, the US air, the US military base, is notorious for imprisoning Afghans and for Afghans to experience torture there. There's been deliberate targeting of wedding parties and funerals because sometimes maybe they think there's been information that perhaps the Taliban have gathered at weddings or funerals. And even though they know, NATO and the US know the majority of people there are civilians, those events have been targeted and there's been mass loss of life by civilians. There's been bombings of hospitals such as Kunduz. And as Malloy Joy also says, the bombing, the mother of all bombs in Nangarhar a few years ago. So the atrocities, I could list them, they go on and on and on. And so reflecting on the US's longest war, £143 billion spent on reconstruction and a total of $2.26 trillion spent on the war. There's been 71,000 civilians, Afghan civilians killed as a direct result of war, 69,000 Afghan troops, 3,500 US and NATO troops, 3,800 private security contractors, and 84,000 Taliban and other militia.
Sorry, it's time.
Okay, so I'll just stop there and then perhaps during the Q&A I will talk about, or the summing up, I'll talk about what we need to keep an eye on for the future.
Thanks very much, Maya. As always, very informative. Now, our last speaker this evening is Tariq Ali, a noted writer and journalist and filmmaker. And he's a veteran of Stop the War and the peace movement. Yeah. So over to you, Tariq.
Yeah, well, I agree with much that has been said by Maya and by Phyllis before her. I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that this last occupation of Afghanistan has been a complete and utter disaster. People have known it for a long time. We've campaigned against it. And it's been a disaster regardless of what the Taliban do and they don't do. Because 20 years is a long time to occupy a country. And at the end of that occupation, as you have nothing now, you've sort of destroyed so much infrastructure that all you can do is leave. But the balance sheet in relation to the people of that country is appalling. Within 20 years, you could have built literally dozens and dozens of hospitals in every major city or small town in the country. You could have created an education system for young boys and girls, provided teachers, built teachers' training colleges. I mean, the liberation of women was always a cynical ploy by the wives of politicians who were making war, that the Afghanistan was going to be the country where we were going to see the first imperialist war for women's liberation. I mean, just think about it. Where have they ever done that in any country of the world, leave alone Afghanistan? But that was the very few people believed or took that seriously, apart from some NGOs, well-meaning NGOs. It was never a serious proposition by the United States or Britain or the other NATO countries that went to intervene there. So why did they intervene? They said, and now it's public, as Phyllis was pointing out, it was a war of revenge. They had to do something after 9/11. Most of the terrorists who attacked the United States in September 2001 were Saudi Arabians or Egyptians. There wasn't a single Afghan amongst them. So if it was to be a war of revenge, why target this unfortunate poor country, which had already been engaged in violence since the Soviets mistakenly entered the country to try and save a radical government? A big, big mistake, as I pointed out at the time. And the reason it was a mistake was because precisely it gave the United States a green light to come and do what they want, which they did. They created the fundamentalist groups, they armed them without the support of Pakistan and the United States. The Taliban would never have come into existence, leave alone actually taken the country after the remnants of the radical government were thrown out and defeated militarily. So, you know, what you reap, you sow. And the notion that the Americans ever thought that they could now fight these guys who they'd put in power, who they'd trained, who they'd armed, who were being sustained by the Pakistani military, and that they could defeat them was crazy, because the links between the Pakistani military and the Taliban have been incredibly close since the Taliban came into existence. Without the Pakistani military, there is very little the Taliban could do on their own. They have, since the American occupation, developed support independently of Pakistan. And this we shouldn't forget. Since they were the only group resisting fighting the occupation in whatever way, they did it and were seen as such by sections of the Pashtun population. And I have to say this, that there would be more hope of dealing with some of the atrocities of the Taliban, more hope if any secular group and any political current had fought and also tried to take on the Western occupation of their country. None of them did. Many collaborated with the United States, which is a huge problem, and quite a few defended this occupation, including many veteran members of the PDPA, the equivalent of the old Afghan Communist Party. So that has been a huge problem, that there's been no secular resistance whatsoever to the American NATO occupation. So what is going to happen now? I think what was likely to happen is this. The United States will use their air power as a thing to just, you know, make their presence felt, and they will bomb whenever they feel to do, you know, make themselves heard, as the Israelis do in Palestine, as Biden has just done in Somalia, as the United States have done consistently in Iraq, carrying it on in Syria. Why should Afghanistan be any different? The one reason it could become different, and this is not being discussed seriously as yet, but last week, or 10 days ago, a senior Taliban delegation went to Beijing to say to the Chinese, gave them a very strong statement to say, we will not tolerate any destabilization of China in our country, or allow Afghanistan to be used as a base by extra-governmental actors to attack any country. They've said the same thing to the United States. They've now said it to the Chinese. The difference is this. China is now a very big player in that region, economically, politically. Militarily, they haven't intervened, and let's hope they never do. But the civil war, which some people are predicting, would only take place if Iran decided that is what it wanted to do to stop the Taliban taking power, which they will very rapidly, within a few months, I would predict. But because Beijing has good relations with Iran and are now developing relations with the Taliban, it could actually intervene constructively to tell both sides a civil war is impermissible because it will bring back chaos, it'll affect your economies, etc., etc. And that would stop the Shia-Sunni fights, the Pashtun versus the Hazaras in that country. So let's see what happens. I have no hope in the Northern Alliance. These are people who sell their souls, and it's a question of who will offer them more money not to, you know, start fighting. Whether the, if the Chinese can do it, great.
Tarek, sorry, you need to unmute, sorry.
Yeah, man, it's been a disaster, this bloody thing. We've done so many of them, and it carries on. Okay, I'll stop there. I'm just fed up with this.
Okay, sorry about that, Tarek. I'm not sure how you became muted. Okay, now we're going to move on to some questions. So we've had some submitted into the chat. If you wish to ask anything from our speakers, do put your question in the chat and I'll be able to read it out to them. So our first question is from Abu Alamgir from Birmingham Stop the War. And his question is to Phyllis and Tarek, which it asks if you think that there is likely to be a full-blown war between Israel and Iran, and if so, why? Secondly, another question, how will regional powers, Russia, India, China, respond to the new situation that's arising in Afghanistan? And a third question is, will the Western powers, do you think the Western powers will be drawn back into Afghanistan? So if we start with those three questions and then we can take a second round. I don't know who wants to go first. Phyllis, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think I'm not going to get into the Israel-Iran question. We're really trying to keep the focus today on Afghanistan. My quick answer to that is no, I don't think there's going to be a full-scale war. I would like to leave to Tarek the assessment of the regional powers, because I think, Tarek, you know them far better than I. But I would take on the issue about the role of the Western powers. I think that this is going to be a very difficult and two steps forward, one and a half steps back, three steps forward, five steps back kind of withdrawal. I think we're seeing that yesterday and today with this new level of airstrikes against Afghanistan that the US itself calls buying time. They're going to continue to try to buy time. They're already setting up air bases in Qatar and elsewhere in the region to be able to continue to launch airstrikes against Afghanistan. They, of course, will also do that using drones, which are managed out of Nevada, a state in the United States, you know, near Las Vegas. They can drop bombs on Afghan wedding parties and be home in time for dinner, these drone pilots. No one has to be in the area. It will be a little more complicated. They'll have to have in-air refueling, that sort of thing, but the US is very good at that sort of technological arrangement here. So I think that we are going to see an effort. It will be very similar, I'm afraid, to what was talked about in Vietnam as having a decent interval, that was the term that was used, between the time that US troops on the ground are withdrawn and the time that the puppet government that those troops were supporting finally collapses. It was thought at the time of Vietnam that 6 months to a year would be an appropriate interval, a decent interval, where the US would not have to acknowledge that it was responsible for the collapse of its puppet. I think here it will be a shorter time than that, but I think that we will see efforts to keep some shell of a structure alive so that there can be the illusion that the US-backed government that the US picked up, put in a box, dropped off in Kabul and said, zap, you're now a government, based on the assumptions of what the United States thought a government in Afghanistan should look like. Some illusion that that can remain even while the Taliban emerges as the dominant power. I don't think it's going to even necessarily try to take full power. But I would just say one last thing, which is that I think it's important that we recognize that 20 years is a long time for the Taliban as well as for everyone else in Afghanistan and for us. It's a long time and things change. There's a new generation in the Taliban. And while those negotiators who have been living outside, living whether in Qatar, living somewhere else in this period, living in Pakistan, may not have changed anything, there's a new generation in the Taliban that have grown up in this last 20 years, have seen the impact of war on their families. Because we have to remember, these are Afghans. You know, unlike some of the other components of the so-called global war on terror, the Afghanistan version of that global war has been characterized much more in this era by being an Afghan war itself, rather than having huge numbers of people coming in other than the Western powers. On the other side, we didn't see huge numbers fighting back. And what that means, I think, is that there has been a change. People I know who have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan talk of seeing negotiations that succeed at the village level, at the rural level, where 75% of Afghans live, negotiations between local religious leaders, local tribal leaders, and Taliban officials on questions of things like girls' education, healthcare, et cetera. So those changes are underway. I think we won't see them while this war continues until there's a clearer sense of who's in power. But once the Taliban, and I agree with Tarek, that's likely to happen quite soon, once it's clearer that they are in power, I think we will see a very different version in many ways than we have seen in the past.
I hope Phyllis is right. These things have a logic of their own. And I think given what has happened over the last 20 years, for instance, the emergence of China as a huge economic superpower, which is capable of building, rehauling, overhauling infrastructures, which the US has only just now begun to do in its own country, leave alone anywhere else in the world. We will see what happens, but have no doubt about it that the Pakistani military do see this as a tremendous triumph for their strategy. And their strategy was quite clever, I mean, obvious, but, you know, they didn't make any food. The minute the US went into Afghanistan in October 2001, the Pakistanis told the Taliban government, do not resist, full stop. Shave your beards, come over to Pakistan, go into the mountains, do not resist, and bide your time. But they knew perfectly well that a Western occupation in Afghanistan would sooner or later create the conditions for rebuilding guerrilla-style organizations and sending them into, take on the occupying power as best they could, which is exactly what happened. Last week, Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, actually said on television that the Western powers and the Americans, he said, he targeted the Americans, and correctly so, and said they've made a huge mess. They've really messed up Afghanistan. To punish him for that, he didn't get the expected phone call from Biden, which is, the subject of quite a lot of humor in Pakistan at the moment. Meanwhile, a Pakistani military delegation arrived in Washington a few days ago and to meet with the Pentagon. I think that's what they intended, because Pakistan is crucial now for what happens in Afghanistan. It's the most important power. And the head of the ISI, who is normally a careful guy, said, we don't want to upset anyone. And if Imran, our prime minister, has upset you, don't worry too much about it. People say things. But he said, in any case, we have we are not totally dependent on you. We have another iron brother, as he put it, in the region, and that is China. And that China is going to play a key role. So all the indications are that the Chinese are going to exert themselves diplomatically, both with Afghanistan and in with the Iranians, and that the Russians will try and keep the Central Asian republics, use them, I mean, quite openly, to make sure that the country doesn't go into another civil war. That is what these people are saying in the region itself. However, if the United States think that random bombing attacks, random killings of civilians, random destruction of buildings can go on indefinitely, then they will pay a price, not directly, but their puppets will pay a heavy price. And on that note, it's important also to stress, I mean, it was very nice to hear Maya talking about the young women in Kabul. And I'm glad, you know, the NGOs have been helping them and all that. But I fear for them, I will be blunt. And I think the West should do this automatically, that when they decide to wage war on a country in Africa or in the Middle East or in West Asia and kill large numbers of people and install puppet regimes of one sort or another and create a refugee crisis, then while making war, they should factor that in, that, okay, Syria, war in Syria, Merkel, the German chancellor, created a shock and horror situation by saying we'd take a million Syrian refugees, which also led, by the way, to a huge growth of the far right in Germany, but that's another question. But I would have thought that at least 500,000 to 1 million Afghan refugees should be catered for by these NATO countries, which have been waging war and making all sorts of extravagant promises. Britain and the United States in particular should take the lion's share of refugees and offer asylum already so they don't have to flee in a way where they can be targeted and killed. I mean, that is the price you have to pay for war, and that is the price which has been paid in other wars. There was a huge migration from Vietnam, from Korea, which created large populations in that country. The Cuban exiles took over Miami, more or less, etc. I'm not saying that everyone who flees is like that, but in Afghanistan in particular, there's some very good people who've been doing good things, Afghan people, and they have to be protected and they have to be given asylum.
Thank you, Carrick. I'm going to ask Maya to come in now. And I have a question as well that's been directly addressed to you, Maya. So I'll ask that as well. If you want to come back on the other questions that I gave earlier, then of course do so. So this one is, what is the impact of the withdrawal of the US and NATO troops going to be on the drugs trade? What are your thoughts on that? So over to you, Maya.
Okay. Thank you so much. I don't think the US are going to be genuinely withdrawing from Afghanistan. There will be, as the other speakers have said, a continued use of drone warfare. So the thing about drones is that the US and the UK have been flying them in various conflict zones around the world when we're not technically at war with those countries. And that will be the case in Afghanistan. And for geopolitical reasons, Afghanistan is too important for the US to walk away from. That we have to remember that there's over $1 trillion worth of natural materials, precious rare earth metals in Afghanistan. So that's one reason you'll want, there'll be, you know, international corporations wanting to mine in those countries. And another reason, as Tarek has been talking about, Afghanistan borders China and Iran. So strategically, it's a key country, especially for the US. So they will not be entirely withdrawing. They will be using drone strikes and aerial bombing as a leverage with the Taliban in order to get what they want and they're in order to keep hold of their strategic positioning. And they may even also use aid if aid is, I think aid will continue to be sent to Afghanistan. And so those will be the key leverages in the same way they've been pieces during the peace talks. That's what the US have been using to leverage with the Taliban. And I agree with Phyllis around perhaps there is some hope that the Taliban, they have changed over the last 20 years. And it's important to bear in mind that around 65% of the population is under the age of 25. And so the internet in the last 20 years has just expanded in ways nobody could ever imagine. So there has been this huge exposure to the rest of the world that young people, especially through mobile phones, have been able to absorb. And I think with all the younger generation who have managed to go to school, especially in Kabul, the young women that I've met are fearless and they know what's coming. So in the 90s, people were unsure of the Taliban. They were unknown quantity and people thought, well, let's give them a try. Maybe this is stability. But now people know what they have vivid memories of those dark days and women especially. I'm not willing to go back to that. So that there is hope that this younger generation who I've worked with, who I know, and who are engaged with a lot of really meaningful grassroots projects, such as the youth group that I work with. They run street kids schools and they equip people with solar pots and run peace education for street kids, all this sort of stuff. There's a lot of this happening across Afghanistan that we, of course, you're not going to really hear about in the news. So that is the hope. And I would also put a plea out for reparations and for that money to go to the grassroots, because obviously a lot of that reconstruction money went into things like, you know, building ghost schools or ghost hospitals. They were soaked up by foreign contracts, US contracts, and they didn't build what they promised to build. So this money needs to go to the grassroots. In terms of the impact on drugs, so this is it's a massive issue that people don't really talk about. So roughly 10% of the population in Afghanistan is now addicted to opium. And there's been a huge opium, it's like a solar revolution that has fueled the production of opium in Afghanistan. So under the Taliban, around 24% of the world's opium came from Afghanistan. Now it's more like 90% of this very, very cheap, high quality opium that has been grown in the deserts. So thanks to solar power, farmers have bought up small fleets of solar panels and they use that energy to pump water as far as 100 meters underneath the desert. And that irrigates all these fields and has allowed this very, very lucrative crop to take hold in the country. And so as you can imagine, in a war-torn country, 40 years of conflict, there's a lot of people now addicted to opium. And you see it all the time. You go to Kabul, you see the drug addicts and they congregate underneath a bridge, and it's one of the most depressing sights you'll ever see in your life. And for me, as a councillor in Hastings, we've recently received we're part of a multi-million pound project by the government called Project Adder, which is to tackle opium, heroin, and crack addiction in the UK. And it's especially prevalent in deprived towns. So Hastings is one of these towns that's in Blackpool, and Norwich is also, Middlesbrough is also receiving some of this Project Adder money. And it's a little awareness around the fact that this opium is coming from Afghanistan. So I could walk to the shop after this and I will see people on my way to the shop who are evidently opium addicts, and they have the same sort of look in their eye as the people in Kabul that I've seen who live under the bridge. And there's very little awareness of this, and there is going to be, you know, an epidemic sweeping across Britain because of austerity, because life is harder, because of the pandemic, where poor people especially are more prone to taking Class A drugs, and this is a huge issue now that's going to affect this country. So, you know, you might get the Daily Mail talking about refugees coming to this country, but what they don't talk about is this pandemic of opium that will impact this country, as well as in my town as well. We have a lot of homeless people, and a large proportion of those people served in Afghanistan. So you have a broken population of young, well, middle-aged people now who have served in Afghanistan and are not being looked after by the government. So opium, I'm not sure what the Taliban are going to do. Obviously, it's haram and they kept it under control when they were in power in the 90s. But it's very, very lucrative and no doubt a huge tax if the Taliban wanted to. It's a massive income that they could take advantage of. And they did, to a certain extent, have a small income when they were formerly in power. But now, you know, there's it's a multi-billion pound industry. So what they do remains to be seen.
Okay, thank you very much, Maya. I'm going to do one very brief further round of questions. We have had quite a lot in, so I'm really sorry if I'm not able to get to your questions. And we're not taking any from the floor, so please don't put your hands up if you have done so. We've had a number on China, so I'll sort of just put them all into one, really. China's role in the future, particularly in the context of the US pushing for a Cold War in China, and whether China's economic program is likely to bring stability to Afghanistan, and if China is likely to take over the current role that the US has played in Afghanistan. There's another question about the role from the Pakistani army, and also about Iran and what role people think that Iran might play in the future of Afghanistan. And then finally, I'll ask one about, have our experts been surprised by the speed at which the unraveling in Afghanistan has taken place? If our contributors could keep their responses quite brief, we've only got about another 10-15 minutes left. So if you just have sort of 3 minutes each, that would be great if possible. Thank you. Tariq, do you want to go first?
I mean, the role of China is usually economic, though it has been more assertive diplomatically in the region. There's no way they would behave like the United States. That's not their policy. They've not done it, and they would be crazy to do so. They know perfectly well what happened when the Russians tried to mimic the United States, and especially in Afghanistan, elsewhere too, but principally in Afghanistan, what the result of that was for the former Soviet Union. The Chinese won't do it. What the Chinese will do is develop friendly relations, give economic aid, but they won't just give the aid. They will want guarantees that at some stage they will be paid back. They will build infrastructure, like, for instance, in the port of Gwadar on the Balochistan coast, Makran in Pakistan. A whole town has been built by the Chinese, run by the Chinese, and the US are very hostile to it. It's an alternative terminal for oil and trade in general, very modern city. Because they didn't want to be dependent on the Gulf states, which the United States controls. So the Chinese will play their own thing, and I think it's not in their interest at all to have Afghanistan destabilized. They are worried, genuinely worried, about the situation in Xinjiang, and they don't want any terrorist links, certainly, to be established between groups still in Afghanistan and their own sort of dissident citizens. So I think that's as far as China is concerned. As far as Pakistan is concerned, they will play a big role. I mean, they know that. They used to talk of the importance of having Afghanistan for strategic depth vis-a-vis India. That was always baloney, in my opinion. I mean, it didn't give them much strategic depth. But already the Indian government has been forced to have, because knowing what's happening in Afghanistan, the Indian government actually had a meeting with all the Kashmiri leaders they'd locked up and arrested to try and show Pakistan that we want to be conciliatory. So, but without Pakistan's support, direct and indirect, I think the Taliban government will face difficulties. And since Pakistan has been effectively guiding the Taliban for the last 20 years, it'll probably carry on, not to the same in the same sort of intense way, but it will probably carry on in some way. Iran, we will see. But the Iranians, of course, it's worth reminding ourselves, supported the US intervention in Afghanistan because the Taliban treated them as their big enemy because they were Shia Muslims. And that left a very unpleasant experience on both sides. The Taliban said, you back the West. You pretend to be anti-imperialist. You back the West in Iraq. You backed it in Afghanistan, to which the Iranians had no reply because it was true in both cases. So, however, there have been changes and shifts on that too. And the Iranians will defend their own interests, and Iranian interests today are not to pick up fights with people who they could be friendly with. There have been some talks between the Iranian regime and the Taliban, and these, I let's hope, will continue. If China plays a major role, it will certainly do everything in its power to ensure that the Iranians and the Afghans don't fight each other.
Thank you, Tariq. If I ask Phyllis to come in, and then we'll go to Maya. Thank you.
Thanks. I would agree with everything that Tariq was saying. I think on the question of Iran, with the new government coming in, the urgency for the Iranian government right now is less about their diplomatic positioning, except when in an emergency, which the situation in Afghanistan may present to them very quickly, but is more on the economic front. They are desperately eager to get sanctions lifted. And that, as we're seeing, is not going to be easy. The US position is remaining very firm, and particularly with this continuing escalation of anti-China, not only rhetoric, but actions. There's a new naval exercise that just is being launched that's gonna be the biggest in several years, a global military exercise by the United States designed to show that it still remains the sole global military power, challenging China in a very direct way. That's quite dangerous. So I think that our role as activists in the US and elsewhere needs to be very, very focused on this question of preventing further escalation between the US and China. I also want to just end with one other point coming off of something very important that Maya referenced, which is this issue of reparations. The US owes an enormous debt to the people of Afghanistan. The destruction has been massive. And how that happens is not only the problem of the legacy of corruption and the ghost hospitals and ghost schools, all of this just direct corruption into US contractors, US generals, who knows how far it goes, as well as to the Afghan government's own corruption. So we owe an enormous debt of reparations, of compensation, but it's not going to be easy, even beyond the political challenge of getting money. How to make it available to people is going to be hard. We know it should not be directed to the Afghan government. Civil society in Afghanistan is mainly small grassroots organizations who should be getting access to funding for sure, but the kind of massive funds that we as a country owe to the country of Afghanistan is probably at this stage, at least, beyond the capacity of civil society organizations that currently exist to absorb in a realistic way. So how to get that money, whether it's through uneasy alliances like with the United Nations, is that the best way? I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer for that question. But I think it's something we have to take very, very seriously as ending the military component of the US and Britain and NATO. We have to figure out how to get to the next stage of what engagement requires of us, what internationalism requires of us.
That was a panel discussion on Afghanistan that was live streamed last week. We heard from Phyllis Bennis, Tariq Ali, and Maya Evans. Malalai Joya also participated, but her audio was not usable, unfortunately. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.